Tal or Falava, you're with Dateline from RNZ Pacific. I'm Johnny Blades. Coming up,
we see sort of that type of, you know, anti-intellectualism, anti-science, just anti-fact.
Guam's US connections come at a cost in the pandemic. And what's the pandemic been like for people on Pitcairn Island?
You know, we're in isolation anyhow, yet I don't feel isolated.
And Kiribati is hoping that tourists will come to visit its World War II battle sites. The number of deaths related to COVID-19 in Guam has surged to 106. This comes as the US Center for Disease Control and Prevention has issued a level 4 alert for the island, which means there's a very high level of COVID-19 on the island. The CDC is warning people to avoid all travel to the US territory, which has a population of over 165,000 people. The total number of reported cases is approaching 7,000, and some 1,600 people are in active isolation. Now, Guam's the site of a major US military base, and it takes up a third of the island's land. According to the co-chair for the Independent Guam organization, Michael Lujan Bevacqua, Guam's US connection has in some key ways undermined the local response to COVID-19. I caught up with him for a chat, and he told me about the difficulties of life in Guam at present.
You know, one of the most difficult things for people is, of course, not being able to be around family. But what we've seen is that not being able to grieve when, sort of in a collective way, when somebody passes. We've seen that for a lot of people, they've expressed frustration because people in the hospital, they die alone. And then when it's time for the funeral to happen, then there's restrictions on how many people can. And so what is already sort of a difficult year around the world, we see that even the pandemic, it doesn't, sort of the hardship doesn't end when somebody dies. It persists in the way that it restricts how you can grieve, even to that extent. And so one of the things that we can definitely see is that Guam is definitely an American territory, because as we see sort of cases shooting up in the United States, we see the same pattern in Guam. And it's an unfortunate contrast to those around us, because we see that in the Asia Pacific region, we see COVID-free nations around us in the Pacific, in the independent and the freely associated Pacific. But then we also sort of see the United States. And so, but then at the same time, we see sort of that our lifeline, in a sense, what's keeping our economy afloat is, of course, federal aid from the United States. So on the one hand, we can see sort of our difficult position as a territory. If we had greater sovereignty, greater control over things, we could lock down the island, sort of cut it off. We could partner with countries such as Taiwan to sort of more effectively combat the virus. But on the other hand, we get all this aid from the United States, but also that what comes with it then is sort of a culture of how to deal effectively or ineffectively with the virus as well.
So it's that intersection that Guam has with the US. This really has cost Guam in this pandemic.
Yes, it really has. So it's sort of the connection to the United States. It has provided stimulus funding, although that funding will run out sort of next month. And people worry about what's going to happen if the United States doesn't come up with another stimulus package. But at the same time, being a territory means that you cannot pursue a completely different course. So early on in the pandemic, we had a country like Taiwan that wanted to sort of provide more direct aid to Guam, but it's not allowed to because Guam is a territory of the United States and the United States recognizes a one China policy, which means Taiwan and other countries cannot directly help Guam, and Guam cannot work directly with them. And then even just at the very beginning, you know, there was issues of shut down the airport, shut the island down. And people forget that, you know, if you're a territory of the United States, you can't shut down the island. The federal government controls the border, the U.S. federal government, which means that if they keep the country and its territories open, you can't necessarily shut everything down like we see other islands doing. It's tough because you see that an island like Palau, for example, which is freely associated with the United States and more independent, Palau received financial aid from countries throughout Asia. It received financial aid from the United States. It was able to completely shut down. It was able to implement the program sort of that it wanted. And so we see sort of the strange position where we're in, where we have this connection to the United States, but we also see that at certain times, the cost of it one of the big issues that sort of divided the community for a time was how do we relate to the U.S. military on the island in a pandemic? You know, there was the famous incident of the Teddy Roosevelt, the aircraft carrier, coming into Guam. And some people said that the governor shouldn't allow them to come to Guam. But a lot of people miss the fact that the governor doesn't necessarily have the power to prevent them from coming to Guam. This is a U.S. territory. And so we can see that the contradictory desires that people have to stay safe, but also because we're so interconnected to the United States, we also sort of rely on them because we can't seek other options. What I see when I see something happening in the United States, like we see sort of the anti-mask movements, you know, I always get kind of worried because we see them also coming into Guam. And that's one of the things that's made a lot of the guidance from the government difficult, is that you have the government puts out a press release, they may take out some public service announcements, but then you've also got all over Facebook people that are sharing all of these different posts, which may be completely made up, or, you know, may just be sort of that my uncle had the coronavirus and he said that if you drink lemon, you know, lemon infused water, that's the best treatment for it. So it's just unfortunate that we see sort of that type of, you know, anti-intellectualism, anti-science, just anti-fact.
Yeah.
Sort of we see that come into Guam. And so I think that's done a lot to kind of undermine sort of how, sort of one thing that's connected to that is, of course, the fact that the U.S. military has their own way of doing things. And it trickles down from the top, you know, from Trump at the very top of the U.S. military to different commanders down to sort of your regular soldiers, sailors, and airmen. But we see that oftentimes amongst the military stationed on Guam, there's less of a willingness to take those public health guidelines seriously.
They're a law unto themselves?
When they come off base, then they should be accountable to the sort of the laws of Guam. But I think that perhaps the governor and the current administration doesn't want to push that. There was a very publicized case when things were starting to get better, where several dozen airmen who were supposed to be quarantined in a hotel, and they were only a local hotel, and they were only supposed to drive to work, to go from their hotel to work on the Air Force base. They had for a month just been wandering around the island, just eating in restaurants, sort of going to stores, doing whatever they wanted. And that was 5 or 6 months ago. And we've pushed to try to get information on, were they ever punished? Did anything come from that? And the military won't tell us.
How's the kind of spiritual health of Guam's people, given a lot of people have been sick and died?
I think the spiritual health of the people has definitely taken a toll. I think 2020 is the year when a lot of communities and institutions, when they are forced to adapt. And it's a real test. But for the most part, people have sort of hung in there. You know, people have figured out ways to adapt. And so older people, it's oftentimes, you know, that sort of the matriarch and the patriarch are sort of the elders in the family. You gather around them when they have special important days, like birthdays and so on. And we've seen that for sort of a lot of older revered elders, drive-by birthday parties, right? Where sort of the elder comes out and sits in front of the house, and then people line up in their cars, and then they can come out, and then from their car, they can sing to them, or they can wave to them, they can leave gifts for them. And so there's ways that we have adapted. And I think that, you know, what we just need to do is we just need to remember the strength of the people on the island. You know, that in Guam, we deal with typhoons, we deal with earthquakes. My grandparents were occupied by the Japanese in World War II. We're born from tough stuff.
Michael Lujan Bevacqua of the Independent Guam Organization. Pitcairn Islanders have lost thousands of dollars in potential revenue from cruise ship visits because of the pandemic. Just 42 people live on the isolated Pacific Island, and tourism had been a growing part of the economy until COVID-19 struck. Many of the islanders are descendants of Fletcher Christian and his mutineers, and they make souvenirs and other things to sell to passengers on board the ships that anchor offshore. But the tiny British territory stopped contact with outsiders in March to keep the coronavirus out. A local resident, Miralda Warren, told Sally Round they were due to have the highest number of visits this year, 21, but only three ships made the trip.
We're very strict. No yachts, no ships are allowed to stop. We've had a few come by, but they haven't been allowed to come ashore or anyone is allowed to go out in their boats and visit.
How much do you think the economy has suffered as a result of the pandemic?
Quite a bit. I would say each family, because we depend on the cruise ships and we also depend on the tourists that would come and homestay and stuff like that. So probably an average home would pull in something like between 12,000 to 20,000 a year, New Zealand dollars, to where, you know, it's almost non-existent anymore. However, our sales of honey has increased online, which has been pretty good. And our company, Pipco.pn, we've taken in quite a few orders over the last couple of months. So the honey is still flowing. However, it's terribly, terribly slow. And it's patience to our customers. Some of them are really, really good. And they really appreciate it, but some of them just, I can't say the word over the air.
How are people coping if they're not getting that 20,000 that they're used to getting? Or does it not matter because you're an island and you're pretty self-sufficient?
One of the things is the overseas development funding. For the very, very first time, they've privately helped each individual resident that's here on Pitcairn. We don't get our fingers on the funds, but it goes to our store bill and it also helps to pay off our medical loan that some of us have got. So each resident here is getting $500 per month.
When did you start getting that?
We started that in September.
Merelda Warren says she feels privileged to live in one of the very few places to be COVID-free.
It feels really, really great to be on a paradise island. And it's quite emotional. It's, you know, we're in isolation anyhow, yet I don't feel isolated. Sometimes I feel sad knowing how many people are dying. I sometimes feel guilty. I'm just living a normal life here on Pitcairn, one that I've known all my life, and others are out there, they're struggling. You know, that makes me really, really sad, but I can still drive or walk around Pitcairn, and I can stop at a bush and pick off a berry or pick off a banana off a tree or mangosteen or pick up taro from the valleys and even go fishing. It's a normal life for me.
That was Pitcairner Merelda Warren speaking to Sally Round. The Tourism Authority in Kiribati wants the world to visit the famous World War II battle sites in the country. In 1942, the British Protectorate of the Gilbert Islands was occupied by Japan, and on November 20th, 1943, the US Marines landed to try and displace them. The agency's chief executive, Petero Manufolau, told Don Wiseman why it's highlighting the impact of the US invasion on the local population with videos of people talking about their experiences.
The idea behind this was an attempt by the Tourism Authority of Kiribati to tell the story of what happened on that fateful morning, the 20th of November, from the perspective of the locals. There is a lot of literature that's been documented outlining the American invasion of Peso to take over from the Japanese, but there's very little literature available or documented on the experiences of the locals. So the aim of this video is really to try and tell the story from the perspective of an Kiribati, and we're quite blessed that we were able to locate some survivors who lived through 77 years to be able to share their stories with us, which is what we'll be doing through a series of video interviews.
And these people, of course, back then would have been children and quite young children, I guess.
Very young, yes. The ones that we interviewed, they would have been in their teens, which is why some of them have a fairly good recollection of what's happened. Others are a bit older, but have become a bit forgetful on what's actually happened. So you're looking at people who are at the oldest at that time would have been 19 or 20.
And this work, in terms of remembering the invasion by the US, what tourism Kiribati is looking to do is to, I suppose, make more of this horrendous part of your history, the battlefields, and encouraging people to travel to Kiribati, to come and visit these places.
That's correct. There are remnants of World War II clearly visible throughout the atolls of Kiribati, and we feel that it's a very strong part of our history. Obviously, one that we hope had never happened, but it did happen nonetheless, and therefore it's a part of our history that we will always remember. It's helped shape who we are today, and with the presence of the war relics and other remnants from World War II, we hope to build on that and to build on a battlefield tourism product to appeal to that niche segment of the market who would be interested to understand more about the United States' involvement in the Pacific theater of World War II, and to also attract the broader audience other than the battlefield tourism niche segment, also as a means of educating our fellow Pacific Islanders, our closer neighbors, Australia and New Zealand, to also understand that in addition to the Solomon Islands, a very important campaign did take place here in Taro, and that's what the Tourism Authority aims to create more awareness on as well.
That's the Chief Executive of the Tourism Authority of Kiribati, Petero Manufalau. Ending this edition of Dateline Pacific, there's more on our website, rnzi.com. Till next time, tōwhā.